Hey everybody, before we start the show, we just have a quick announcement, one that we have been teasing for a while, but we're finally ready to announce it. We have started a Patreon. Woo! So obviously, as you've seen, if you have listened to literally any other podcast, they probably have Patreon too. You know how it works. By an episode-by-episode basis for us, if you donate a certain amount of money, there are certain perks for us, and in return, we are able to just pursue some of the more ambitious goals that we have with this podcast. But we have something to give back for it. Josh, you want to tell them what they got?
Exactly right, Ryan. Tier 1 will be the $1 level, which we are calling our whistle wetters. For $1, you will get a shout-out on an episode. Any way you want, we'll contact you. You can let us know how you want it to be done. Then we'll have the $3 level, which will be our little newsletter we send out every week. And basically, we will be sticking to Snapple facts, but we're not going to limit ourselves to things that we find interesting that week or current events or anything like that that pertains to the show. And we'll send it out every week. You can check it out. It'll be a write-up between me, Ryan, and Greg, and we'll send it right to your inbox. You can read anytime you want.
We know everybody loves spam emails, but we'll keep this one entertaining. Trust us. And at $5, we'll have Patreon-specific episodes where our patrons will get episodes where we cover things like urban myths, things that didn't get into the show. It's a whole breadth of things that we would like to cover that generally don't fall into the category of what our regular season episodes would be.
At the $10 level, we're going to have the Rumor Mill. A group of lucky patrons are going to be able to dictate an episode we have to do. They're going to come up with all the topics, and we get to release it to the general public, and all the people involved are credited. In addition, they get invited to a special live stream where you get to watch behind the scenes of us doing an episode. You'll get to join us on special Google Hangouts for fun discussions and Q&As, and we'll sometimes even do our Twitch stream where you can join us for fun games.
Yeah, so lots of interaction with us, whether you want it or not.
You're stuck with us.
Anyway,
I think they technically have to want it.
Yeah, pretty much. So anyway, please consider donating to the Patreon. It means the world to us. We have some of the best listeners, very interactive, and we just want to keep this show going with the best quality that we can. So enjoy.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Rumor Flies. I'm Josh.
I'm Ryan.
Oh, no you're not.
I'm Ryan.
And I'm Greg with Undead Media.
We're kicking off episode 4, season 4, historical figures. Let's do it. We've gone over history the last couple seasons, but we're kind of doing a grab bag this episode where we're focusing on historical figures, very prominent, typically leaders. I don't think any of them have not been president or prime minister or whatever, commissioner, fantasy draft owner, whatever it is. Yeah, this is all historical figures. It's kind of a grab bag of different people, different things throughout different periods of time, because normally we focus on a specific era. So I'm really excited about this. But before we get into the episode, Ryan, you want to give us a plug?
Yes, our plug for Dark Myths is going to be Monsters Among Us by Derek Hayes. This is a very interesting type of, I want to say cryptid / paranormal type of show where users can call in, tell their stories, and then Derek goes ahead and comments on it or just kind of takes apart the entire story. Not as in like a takedown way, but as in just kind of like gets into the nitty gritty of it during it. It's pretty creepy, honestly. I like it very much, especially just like user submitted content sometimes feels very genuine. So
there's that originality factor where it's not scripted. You don't know what's going to happen. And you have to adapt to what people give you. And the fact that you're able to sit there and discuss it, dissect it, and analyze it makes the show even better.
Yeah, and props to him for the most part, because it's just kind of like, imagine people just come and just drop like a folder full of like topics that we have to cover on. Just like, oh, well, guess I gotta put some flair on this one, but
here's my tax returns from 5 years ago. Can you see what you can do with it, please?
Listen to Monsters Among Us. It's doing really well, and it is worth the listen. So that's that for right now. Are we ready to jump into the episode?
Yep.
So
we're you start off.
Historical figures? Okay. So as we said, we're covering historical figures, or I guess at least the little tidbits about them that made them debatably notorious, famous, infamous. I don't know what you would say.
I guess all the above.
Some of these guys
really
are
really excited about this one.
Yeah, Greg is going to be.
Let's be fair. Greg has a history boner all the time.
We're Green Power. We're Green Power ranging Greg
Dan
for
Carlin.
This one. He's going to be the one that comes in and just like saves the day. So we're going to have a lot of Greg.
What ends up happening in the situations is people always go like, hey, well, you don't know the specific date and year of this really random thing in history? Thought you were a history major.
You know what?
They just download the dates into our brains.
Hey, Greg, when? Which
I'm
was
Neo, but history. Plug it in.
You know
which
what?
Was the first Technicolor film?
I hate you.
You know
I hate
what?
You. No, I've suffered for that.
Ryan, we you're wrong. Greg is not Green Power Ranging it. He's White Knighting it, okay?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, the Green Power Ranger eventually becomes the White Power Ranger.
Yeah.
Except in Japan, did you know that...
that face.
I said White Power Ranger. I didn't say the White Power Ranger. So anyway, we're going to be covering a lot of historical figures and what made them famous, infamous, or just notorious in some circumstances. Actually, for a lot of these, this is kind of like little side notes about them that should have made them a little bit more savory or unsavory. And the first one we're going to jump into is going to be somebody where I was going to take one topic, but it turns out you can cover this in guy's entire life because it is riddled with murkiness and tons of little bitty tiny rumors about him the entire time.
Little tiny bitty rumors.
And that is Napoleon Bonaparte. I suppose most people know who he is. So for a short background in case some people...
Short background!
Yes, that went a little bit about Napoleon in case they don't know.
Little bit about Napoleon. I got all night.
Is that... please not all night. Is that Napoleon Bonaparte became, he rose to prominence during the French Revolution and eventually became the first and, as far as I know, only emperor of France during the French Revolution. Well, rather after it. And he was Emperor Napoleon I from 1804 to 1814 and then again in 1815 after a short retaking of power and then once again being overtaken.
He took a sabbatical.
Yeah, just a little bit of sabbatical.
Took a vacation.
Hiatus, let's call it like that.
Wasn't Napoleon technically the only person to conquer Russia, like march into Russia and actually do well?
Don't throw those at me. Greg did Russian history, tell me.
I mean, he didn't technically. I mean, he, like most people, he didn't conquer Russia, but he did irreparable damage to the country that haunts them to this day.
You know, besides Russia.
The Mongols are technically the only ones I think you've conquered.
Yeah.
What was technically
okay.
Russia, but it was not technically Russia yet.
Right. Correct. Okay. I knew I was somewhere along the lines, but I knew that.
If we're looking at a modern map.
But wasn't he? He did it in the winter as well.
He brought in over 400,000 troops, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Invaded Russia, and they went back freezing and dying and horrified. That was where the whole scorched earth thing kind of made its name.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's where I was going with this.
Well, there goes your food. So, anyway, what we're going to be covering to start with is the idea of the Napoleon complex, which everybody's heard of that, right?
Yeah, little man syndrome.
Yeah, little man syndrome where a chihuahua will bark at like a Great Dane and think it can, you know, kick its ass with like one fell swoop. That is the main attribute. I'd be so pissed off if I was Napoleon. That's what people attributed to me, just being a short guy and being a little bit too tall in my mind.
A little bit too tall.
Yeah.
Got all
just,
night.
You know what? You want to keep... I'm not f***ing Yogi Berra, okay? Don't make me that.
So
because I'm picking Nick Baskets?
I will... I'm actually kind of...
Not Yogi Bear.
Yogi Berra, the baseball player. Hey, boo-boo, I'm hit a home run. It's a dick high fastball down the middle. At least with Napoleon, like you say that you don't want to be known for that, but I would venture to say that most people, like the general population, know who Napoleon Bonaparte is, not because he was short, but because of the things that he did.
Yes, but I think that is some, like, if you picture Napoleon in your head, most people picture him as short, traditionally,
like
now, because of that.
Can we hear that from a pretty young age, at least from my experience.
So, I mean, the term exists.
We can all agree that, like, we're thinking, like, Tyrion Lannister kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, that's, like, instantly
well,
pops in
not
my mind.
I don't think that's short.
That short.
But something similar to where you have all these people that are obviously much taller than you are, and you are this great tactician, master of war kind of thing, who's very, very intelligent, but you also lack the height that other people do. And you are looked down upon.
He doesn't punch down on anybody, mm-hmm. no matter how tall he is.
Let's keep going with these.
So, anyway... To start with Napoleon complex, this started mainly right when Napoleon died. So I guess a short history of him. He actually was exiled to...
St. Helena prison.
Yes. And afterwards, he actually left his exile
Putting that degree to use over there. You keep going.
Came back, had to abdicate the throne again in 1815, and then died in exile, essentially. And he actually has a very cool tomb, which is still still intact to this day. But when he was buried, there was a turning point for standardization of measurements. And there was the English measurement system and the French measurement system. So in the Napoleonic times, there was the French measurement system, which clocked him in at roughly 5'2", which is pretty tiny. Damn short. Yeah, you know, that's for just about anybody. It's like, it's short.
Yeah.
Turns out
though, for a male.
Yes.
For a male, yeah.
But it turns out that the French units are 1 pied, which is 1 French foot, so one of Greg's feet, was about 12.8 inches.
He wishes.
Approximately. There's a few reasons why people would think he's short. Number one, that measurement. But it turns out that the English measurement system he was actually about the modern day is about 5'6". So exactly,
that's pretty average.
Exactly my height. The thing is that this is not average height for my time. I'm pretty short in terms of, you know, current averages. But in Napoleonic times, that was the average height. He was no taller or no less tall than the average, you know, Frenchman. But at the same time, there's a little bit more to kind of add into that. Number one, he wasn't tall for the standard infantrymen. Like, usually soldiers are taller than the common population. Like, you know, the whole Star Wars thing. Aren't you a little short to be a stormtrooper type of deal?
Ah, yes, 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 yes.
So it's that type of thing. But also, all of the Napoleonic guards, he pretty much had, like, the old France equivalent of point guards on his side at all time. Like, he always had really tall people next to him for his guards, just to be intimidating in general. So if it wasn't him, it was the people around him.
But not only that, in turn, that makes him look shorter.
Yeah, so that's what people kind of like saw him as being shorter. And to stack onto that, even though Napoleon, once again, he is a completely normal height at the time. So anybody writing about Napoleon would not say he was exactly a short dude. It's just in historical context now, that is what we would see it as if you were to say 5'6". So looking back now, yeah, he is kind of short. It is not the person that most people would go for on Tinder. But at the same rate, he is normal for the time. Not only that, Napoleon actually isn't traditionally French in the most technical of terms. He was born in Corsica, which is in Italy, but it was transferred over to France only a year before he was born. So yes, we can say that he was French, but he was born in traditionally Italy. He was from a minor noble Italian family at the time. And he didn't even learn French until he was about 9 years old.
You know, Bonaparte, it's got a vowel in the end.
He was born Napoleon di Bonaparte.
Yeah, I never thought about it. Yeah.
No, nobody would think to because French Revolution, Napoleon, nobody thinks Italy of that one.
No, you're right.
So it's kind of interesting the fact that, like, you know, it's kind of like, say, Hitler was it was technically Austrian. We'll get to him later. But
don't be shitting on my stuff, Ryan.
I'm not. So anyway, Napoleon actually was probably shorter because Italians actually are mean stature, shorter than most of the rest of Europe.
Yes, as Italians, Ryan and I can attest that we are very short. It is just our nature.
Now we are. We were perfect back then, okay?
That was a big, beautiful
That was
boy.
The best part about being in Japan. I was too tall for some door frames.
I had to duck down sometimes, and it was wonderful.
I felt completely average. Continue with Napoleon. There was actually a few different little tidbits that I want to touch on him before we move on to your topic, Josh. Napoleon actually did have this famous chess match with something called the Turk. Has anybody heard of the Turk?
Mm-hmm. Greg? Yeah, he's the guy in Scrubs, right?
Not the guy in Scrubs.
The Turk was legendarily, it was claimed to be the first automatic chess playing machine. In some cases, some would call it a first version of the computer. But do you want me to continue the story?
Going. He was essentially the Deep Blue of
And they called it the Turk because there was kind of racist or cultural stereotyping, whatever you want to call it, a idea that Turkish men were particularly good at chess. So it was literally like mechanical.
I'll take
Turkman.
That stereotype.
The guy looks like, he looks Turkish, got a turban, he like sits at the chessboard and you play it and his hands reach out and move the pieces. And
so it was like an automated machine.
Automated machine.
Wow. Okay.
You know those dumb like fortune tellers you put a coin in?
Yeah, it kind of looks like that, actually.
That's exactly what I was thinking of.
The thing is, though,
we're collectively racist.
They would find either someone with, I do not know the proper medical term, dwarfism, whatever you want to call it.
Little people?
I guess little people. I apologize for not looking this up, just like we did with Inuits. But anyway.
Hey, we nailed that one down.
They would find someone who was particularly small. And they would put them under the chessboard, like inside the machine, and they would move the pieces from inside. Like they would move the hands and like manually do it.
So I didn't hear that it was a person of smaller stature because that, like, you have to fill
two
criteria.
Because the box wasn't that big.
We need someone that's really smart and really small.
Well, I was going to say, they obviously had to have some kind of intelligence and able to do that.
Yeah, I'm not. I remember learning this years ago in undergrad, so my details are a little hazy, but I remember it being it wasn't particularly big.
The long story short is that there was a man inside of the Turk. Whew, that sounds weird. But there was a man inside of the machine manipulating the entire game as Napoleon was playing against him. So he thought he was beaten by just a mechanical automaton, which is kind of interesting because there's no memory in there or anything that would be required to be able to play a chess game. It was just really, really impressive showmanship. It was a nice little power trick that turned out being famous, and Napoleon lost his shit when he lost against the Turk.
Wow.
But that actually did happen. So that's actually, I think, what probably made the Turk most famous was beating Napoleon, one of the greatest tacticians, arguably, in Western history.
Any sort of military history, everybody wants to talk about Napoleon.
Yes.
For how brilliant he was. Yeah.
I would love to see a Civilization V game between Genghis Khan and Napoleon, and who else could we throw in there for some of the sides? Like the actual ones. Hannibal? Not Gandhi, because he doesn't actually do nukes in
what? Hannibal.
Hannibal would have been pretty cool.
I was thinking someone in Rome, yeah.
Hannibal. Alexander the Great.
Yeah, that's the other one I was thinking of.
You're welcome.
We'll just throw Tyrion Lannister in there too. So anyway, another thing about him, Napoleon was such a paranoid person that he apparently carried a vial of poison on him at all times in case he was captured. Now,
so like the original, what do they use to take?
Cyanide,
like the
prepper?
Original cyanide pill, yeah.
Yeah, the original type of doomsday prepper or any of those type of people. Yes, he actually had poison around his neck at all times, and he supposedly did take it once he was captured at the end of the Battle of Waterloo.
Wow.
However, it had degraded to the point that it did not kill Napoleon. He just got
very, very sick.
Very, very sick for a couple of days and then was exiled.
It's like, what was his name? Gabriel Princep, before the whole assassination thing. That whole plot, the guy who originally tried to assassinate Ferdinand, he threw a grenade that was defective. And then he jumped in the water to drown himself, and it was too shallow. So he bit a cyanide pill that just made him throw up. It was defective cyanide pill.
Gavril Princip was like the Eugene from Hey Arnold of history. Like, everything wrong happened to him under the right circumstances. He ended up getting the right outcome from it, but I feel like he stepped on a rake on the way over there. And then if you listen to Dan Carlin's episode on what's the whole series called? Blueprints for Armageddon.
Yeah.
That was he was in a sandwich shop when he saw,
literally, yeah.
Archduke Franz Ferdinand pass and was like, well, here's mess two for chance, and just goes and shoots him. So that is essentially Napoleon had a strike of bad luck. Also, there was the whole type of association between Napoleon and pigs. For a while, it was actually supposed that you could not ever associate Napoleon with a pig. It was legal to the point where you could not name a pig in France Napoleon. To the point where even the George Orwell novel Animal Farm, in the original French editions, they named Napoleon the pig Caesar instead of Napoleon.
Huh.
Wasn't that the name of the pig in Limetown as well?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, it was.
So, but that's actually more of a reference to Animal
Farm.
You
get a plug. You get a plug. Everybody gets a plug today.
I was about to say, and then when you said Animal Farm, I'm like, oh, obviously it's for Animal Farm then. That's probably the actual reference.
So the thing is, though, now if you look at a modern rendition of, a modern copy of the French version of Animal Farm, he's named Napoleon again, but it actually was Caesar in one of the earlier editions. So they actually had some reverence for that to the point where it lasted that long. And then the last little tidbit about Napoleon is his other Napoleon
complex.
His little tidbit. I didn't know this until recently, but apparently Rumor has it that when Napoleon was being, when his autopsy was had, he had several parts removed from him. Some people say it was like two pieces of rib, his heart, but most famously, it was Napoleon's little dick. And I say little dick because they say that, well, it still exists. Apparently, it has been passed down through the ages, and it's one of those things where it's like Galileo's like pinky finger or something like that. Napoleon's penis was actually extracted from his body before he was buried and preserved, and now through very many handoffs, it ended up in a basement in New Jersey.
Handoffs?
So there was a private collector, ha ha ha, that has Napoleon's penis in a basement of her house. Now,
it's not quite as august as like St. Francis Xavier's like hand. Like, this baptized so many hands, and it's like Napoleon's dong. Like,
in his defense, though, everybody says like, oh, it's actually not that impressive. It's like, it's shriveled up and preserved. Like, I don't know. I didn't look up the picture. I should have done that. But no, like,
I don't think that's a big deal this time.
But I think time has taken its toll on it at that point. But.
Well, I'm going to put it to you this way. Like, if I'm swiping right on Tinder and I'm bringing a girl home and I'm like, say, baby, you want to see Napoleon's dick? I don't think it's going to be a good night anyway.
I don't think that was ever the case for any situation for anybody who held that.
That's yet. What I would go with. Yeah. You don't know that, Ryan.
You can charge to like have people see it, but at the same rate.
Come on. Napoleon's penis. Yeah. $100 a pop.
So if you are ever inclined to knock on some private collector's door in New Jersey and look for Napoleon's penis, you might actually get a little peek at some history.
A little peek?
I mean, his death mask is boring, so why not just look
at it? If you send us a picture, I'll send you a postcard and some hot sauce.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So
I will give props out.
Are we just...
I send nudes.
So, yeah, guys, we're asking for dick pics, right?
Yeah. Not in general. We are officially saying we are.
We are
not,
Rumor Flies on Snapchat.
We're asking for dead, desiccated dick pics. That's Greg. That none of us.
Okay, let me stop all this nonsense right here. I've actually been to Waterloo. It's one of the few places in the world that I'm very proud of that I've been.
That's pretty cool.
I've only traveled out the country a handful of times, and I've been to Waterloo, and I actually remember seeing Napoleon's outfit. They actually had it on display.
You've been to Belgium?
No, it wasn't Waterloo. Fuck. Where was I in France? I was with your people. I was somewhere. They had Napoleon's outfit. It wasn't Waterloo, but it was somewhere else that was important. Disregard where it was. It doesn't matter.
I think I've seen his outfit in France. One of his uniforms in France as well.
I forget where it was. Yeah, it was where he rode the horse. It was one of the big battles where he rode it. It was like this nice big fountain up front. I can't remember.
Beautiful fountain. You wouldn't believe it.
It was the best fountain. And they had his uniform on display. And I remember thinking like, oh yeah, Napoleon's really tiny. But I'm looking at this and I'm like, this isn't small.
That's
like,
a big horse.
I wasn't looking at the horse. Horse penis. I was looking at the outfit. And... and I remember thinking though, like he looks normal. Like it looks like your average Joe's, like, I mean, obviously attire at the time, but it would be no different than jeans and a t-shirt. Like of what you would suspect somebody who's about our height. No different than a
Gene Simmons t-shirt.
Yes, a Gene Simmons t-shirt. Yes. With the tongue hanging out and it goes all the way to his dongle. And it was interesting because I didn't want to, you know, normally we don't research each other's topics or anything like that, but that's something I wanted to bring up because I've actually seen it. I've actually seen what he used to wear. And it just looks like what you would see somebody wearing today. Like as far as lengthwise, I mean, like it was not like you look at it and say that belonged to a little person or anything like that.
Right. It wasn't like they dressed a kindergartner up as a military general.
So, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, a three-piece suit like some people.
So that's it for Napoleon. Josh, what you got?
My first topic of this evening is something that I've never heard of, but Ryan has. And it's Hitler had a
scalp. Don't ask about my search history.
I don't. We all know Greg searches strictly in incognito mode. Hitler had a scat fetish.
During this show, I do.
Yeah, Hitler had a scat fetish, okay? That is what...
Josh, what's scat?
Okay, well, I'm glad you asked. Just so we're clear, though, when I say this, I do mean that Hitler, though. I just want to clarify.
Not Rudolf Hitler?
No, that Hitler. Scat, you know what, Ryan? We're going to save that. I'll get to it later.
Okay.
There's actually a name for it. I didn't know there was an actual name for it. Like an actual name for that fetish.
Oh, is it in German?
No, it's in English.
Oh, okay, because, like, German always has those different things, like Schadenfreude. I really like that term. They have, like, a million words for, like, just weird types of concepts that I wish existed in English.
Yes, yes. I took German for a semester that we talked about earlier, and that definitely came up a couple times, and I'm like, why don't we,
like,
have this?
I'm surprised we don't have a word yet for taking joy in other people's misery. That's Schadenfreude.
Yeah.
Like, that's what it is. They have one word for that. We have to make, like, a whole sentence of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I agree. But there is a whole Wikipedia dedicated to Hitler's sexuality, and I believe, let me just double check this, and it's literally called Sexuality of Adolf Hitler. That's literally what the Wikipedia is called. So,
oh, man, that was tough.
Yeah, well, I couldn't remember.
So obscure.
Okay. Anyway, so Hitler liked to get his fuck on. I'll just throw that out there. But the interesting thing is the ramifications that it had.
That's going in like, the Rumor Flies, like, quotes board on the wall.
Yeah.
Just from now on.
That'll be the new Rumor Flies bingo. Hitler liked to get his fuck on. The people that Hitler ended up being with sexually, it was very fascinating. Two of them actually committed suicide. And one of them attempted suicide and failed. And a fourth one attempted suicide, failed, but died from complications of the attempted suicide like 8 years later. So it definitely took its toll on people being in a relationship with him.
Damn, like that. How many people?
That's four people right there. And he had many, many partners, which, okay, I'll get into. So most people know that Hitler had a wife. Anybody know her name?
Eva Braun.
There we go.
But she only got married before they, had the...
A mere 40 hours before they killed themselves in the bunker.
Supposedly.
I was waiting for it. All right, Yashil. Yes, him and Eva Braun married about 40 hours or so before they all committed suicide, before, the end of the... Germany was, in decline and the U.S. was invading and things like that.
Russia.
Yeah, okay. So Hitler was a very, very interesting person. And I don't mean that from the historical standpoint. I mean that from Hitler as a human being. People described him as many different things. And it ranges from asexual to homosexual to heterosexual.
You know how I always pictured him? You've seen Wedding Crashers, huh?
Many times. I love that
movie. Very curious where you're going with this.
Yes, me too.
The creepy son that, like, sneaks into Vince Vaughn's room. I picture that as, like, Hitler in his early days, where he was, like, that very artsy type. He even has, like, the hair in that movie. But, like,
we can play tummy sticks.
I mean, but, yes. But, like, he even was, and I mean, if that's what you're into, that's fine. But, like,
if that's what you're into.
Yes. That's the second time you've done that.
You
tonight.
Set that one up.
No, I, whatever.
Keep going.
He was the artsy type, even though he was actually a veteran. He was in World War I, so,
Yes, that's a very good
point. He's
a little
bit hardened. Not, that wasn't a fucking sexual joke.
Okay, there's no way with that long dramatic pause that was not intentional.
I thought he was going to take the line. I don't know. Just keep going.
Ryan, when have I ever taken the high road?
Okay, just keep going.
Let's just throw that one out there. Okay, so... Throughout people describing Hitler's sexual preferences, whether it be homosexual, asexual, heterosexual, whatever it may be, all across the board, it was brought up that he's a coprophile. I have no idea if that's how you say it.
Crematory. Yeah, that's right.
Crematory, whatever. Coprophile. That's what I'm going with. And that means that he likes it when people poop on him.
Shit lover.
Yes.
That's the literal translation.
Yeah, no, like you are correct. It's funny, but it's true. There is no evidence, though, to actually back this up. Now, the interesting thing, though, about that is if you try to do some research on it, you come across some very interesting references. And you do have that Sexuality of Adolf Hitler Wikipedia article, but you get things from The Sun, which, by the way, that's a garbage newspaper. I'm just going to trash that one to begin with.
Okay.
But things like the Daily Mail, the
also
Metro,
garbage,
the New York Post...
I don't...
The New York Post is also kind of...
But they're enough out there to where you know the name. It's not like... Remember we talked about like abc.co.com. Like, it's actual newspaper articles that actually run with it. But the interesting thing is they all have the same goddamn format. They all literally take the same recited garbage that somebody wrote before and just mix it up in their own words. Kind of like when you write a paper on your own.
So first episode of the season, we talked about our classifications of like different news sources and which ones had certain types of validity. I wouldn't put this one as like the ones you just cited, The Sun.
It's not fake
news. The Daily Mail, The New York Post. I would put those not as like the National Enquirer where it's just like, let's write an article about blah, blah, blah. And somebody's like, I didn't hear about that. And like, exactly. And then they just put that out.
Right. It's not clickbait.
They don't exercise journalistic integrity necessarily.
Yeah, they don't pull
a That's story. A great way of putting
they
it.
Don't, Diligence. They don't pull right. a story out of thin air, but they're not exactly the most reputable of the news sources.
Right, okay. So I have, I believe that I've pinpointed the actual origin of this, okay? Now, Hitler's love of the Dookie Dungeon fetish was brought to light by Walter C. Langer, and he wrote a psychological study on him.
Walter Langer.
Yeah. I didn't even think of that. He's actually American, by the way, from what I understand.
Walter Langer.
Yes, Walter Langer.
Why did I go into Obama voice immediately?
I was going to ask that. My fellow Americans. In 1943, he did a study of him called The Psychological Analysis of Adolf Hitler, His Life and Legend. And this was a report that he did for the OSS, which, for those of you who don't know, which is what eventually became the CIA.
Mm-hmm. Operational okay. Strategic Services started at the University of Virginia.
Thank you, Greg.
Okay. That liberal university.
Graduates.
Okay. So this study was done by the Allies in order to help understand Hitler as a person, to kind of predict what he would do and what his tendencies would be and things like that. And this actually was expanded into a book called The Mind of Adolf Hitler, The Secret Wartime Report. Now, I point this out as the origin because a lot of rumors about things of whether he was homosexual, heterosexual, asexual, whatever it may be, Hitler's sexuality stems from all of this, including his scat fetish. Now, it's about 1,000 pages long. This is a long-ass report, or book, actually, now that it's a book. It's a long-ass book, and it went on to make a bunch of different claims, such as, and let me just say this, it made a ton of claims, okay? And some of them turned out to be right. Things like, as war turns against him, his emotions will intensify and he'll have outbursts more frequently. His public appearances will become much rarer because he's unable to face a critical audience. There might be an assassination attempt on him.
Which just explains a normal person that situation for some reason.
Yes, but like things like there will be an assassination attempt on him. Like we all know Tom Cruise tried to do the world a favor.
Did happen. When was this published?
1943.
So this is essentially propaganda, though. I mean,
yeah, I'll get into that. He'll also say, but he did go on to say that there will be no surrender or peace negotiations. And from what we know, the most likely possibility that he will commit suicide. So like he was on the ball with a couple things, like he did nail it. But when you write a 1,000-page book that's spewing a lot of assumptions and interpretations about a certain person, you're bound to get a couple correctly. You know, it's basically the same idea as shooting an arrow and pointing a bullseye around it.
Even yeah. broken clock is right twice a day.
Yeah, exactly. A blind squirrel finds a nut.
Or just, you know, taking a shotgun to a fish tank. You're going to hit one of them fish.
I approve of
and
all
of this.
And
if not,
these.
It's going to collapse a tank and then kill the fish. But that just sounds like, you know, obviously that was a very smart thing on that guy's move. This Walter Langer is his name?
Yeah.
He did something that was very effective back then up until about now. So, I mean, socially, we have, as a people, become, you know, whether kicking and screaming or not, more accepting towards the idea of sexuality. And now, necessarily, outing someone as, like, gay is not going to be a career ender for just about any politician unless there's other baggage to go along with it that makes them seem disingenuous.
I'll even go one step further. If you were to take any politician and say that they had a scat fetish, it would not be the end of their political career.
I don't know about that part, though. That's where I'm thinking, because like you say, saying is gay worked in World War II. That's just what I'm getting at. That would have worked in World War II because that was still seen as just taboo for the most part.
Well, not only that, though, Hitler made a point to send people who were gay to his concentration camps. Like he killed, okay, I believe the number was he sent anywhere from 5,000 to 15,000 people who were gay, and about half of those didn't make it.
Jesus.
So that's about the round numbers. You know, there was no specific like concrete number they could come down on, but they figure anywhere from 5 to 15,000 were gay, and half of those didn't make it. They died inside the camp. So he made it a point to, and he even was very outspoken about homosexuality, saying that he wanted to get rid of it, how it was bad. You know,
well, even on Britain's side, Alan Turing, the man who like broke the Enigma machine. Like,
for those of you who don't know, The Imitation Game, the movie's based off of him.
Yes. He was gay, and it turns out that he was not only chemically castrated, but he was kind of not rewarded for anything he did in the war effort. It was like years and it was decades later until they made a formal apology for the shit that they did to him.
I want to say
just for being gay.
I want to say it was the late 2000s by Queen Elizabeth. Like, and it was, so it was within the last 10 years, I believe is what it was.
She put that on her checklist because she was alive during World War II. She was just I should have gotten to that.
That's why I clarified the time frame, because, you know, she's been around since, well, forever. But but that's why it's so interesting, though, that people want to sit there and say that Hitler was gay. And, you know, there is that, you know, that tendency people like to point out that, you know, if you are homophobic or whatever it is, it's because you have those tendencies yourself and you're trying to repress them and whatever the case may be. But there was nothing that pointed to Hitler being homosexual.
It was a tabloid.
That's exactly it. There was nothing that pointed to Hitler having a scat fetish or anything like that. There was a lot of finger pointing to him being into an incestual relationship with his niece, who was, oh man, I want to say she was like half his age. Like, she was really, really young, and I believe she ended up killing herself.
Yeah, as it was a bit of a Woody Allen situation.
Ooh, boy.
Yeah, it's true, though. But yeah, no, you're exactly right. I've also heard, side note, that we'll probably get to this at some point. I also heard that Hitler was also into his own mother. He had an Oedipus complex.
See, all these things are just sounding like perfect propaganda. It sounds like I'm advocating for Hitler right now. But no,
you're not.
What I'm saying is that this is perfect because they're in wartime. Nobody on the opposing or even, there's on the British or German side at the time. I'm just going to use those two. But the Allies
or the Axis powers.
None of those are going to take the time to substantiate that because they're fighting a war. There's no time to actually, like, go into the nitty-gritty of that and find out whether it's true or not. So it's just kind of like, take it or leave it. And most of the time, if it bolsters your country's national identity or confidence, you're going to take it.
And not only that, when you look at it now, we're sitting here. I mean, the war ended. Hitler died in 1945. We're in 2000.
Supposedly.
Well, you know, unless he went to Brazil, but we'll get to that.
Argentina.
Time. We'll get to that another time. we're sitting here in 2017 speculating on the sexuality of one of the most notorious men in history of all time. Okay. That wasn't something they were concerned about probably much, you know, until recently. Let's be honest. So here we are as revision history, looking back at things, trying to figure this stuff out. So all we have to rely on is the journals, the diaries, and the reports of people from back then. And a lot of people who were either around when these questions were being asked all reported it as either propaganda, bullshit, slander, whatever you want to call it.
I'm only going to interject really quickly that's not revisionist history because that usually has a negative connotation.
Well, it does have it. Yeah, well, when they're trying to paint somebody in this negative light.
I was saying in vernacular. It's generally, I was saying we are not conducting revisionist history.
No. But what I'm saying is that that they're trying to take this man and they're trying to portray him in a certain light that's not true.
Sure.
Oh, the whole killing 6 million Jews thing didn't work? Did you know he was gay?
Well, that's exactly it. Exactly. He was the painter as well.
Oh, you don't care about that? Did you know he ate shit? Like, that type of thing.
Like, in the broad spectrum of things, like, it doesn't change all the atrocities, all the horrible things that he did. But at the same time, I'm going to be fair here. There's nothing that backs any of this up. Like, that's the main issue here, is that
I can definitely see a logic that's like propaganda is executed even in, like, past the fact.
Well, okay.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm with you.
What,
like,
what's
I,
the...
I can see that. I mean, if there's no valid source, it's like, it's hard to
what's
say
the,
it.
Greg, I have something for you to look up. What is the, I guess, the theory or the whatever it is, I guess it's a theory that when you're arguing on the internet, it will be compared
Darwin's
to...
Darwin's law.
Thank you. Yeah, the law. Thank you.
That it will be degrade to be a Hitler comparison.
Exactly. I mean, but there's a reason for that, because people view him as such a negative, terrible human being, and rightfully so, you know, he did a lot of atrocities and a lot of terrible things.
Made a name for himself.
Exactly. But then they're also trying to paint this other picture of him that's not justified.
No, I get what you're saying. It's the idea that's like, it's like with politics and things, it's that whether you were for or against somebody, whenever you're making a case, I remember distinctly during all the stuff with like during Obama's presidency, a lot of things came out. And I remember talking to people who I disagree with politically, and I went, there are a lot of legitimate complaints and things you can say about things. But when you start throwing in wild speculation, unsubstantiated claims,
personal attacks.
Yes, that are also, again, often unsubstantiated.
That's an easy cut down for somebody to say you're wrong about that immediately.
It undermines
anything else you said.
It undermines your legitimacy.
And even if they are.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And so that's the whole point I'm trying to make. Whether Hitler did or did not have a scat fetish, it really doesn't matter. There's nothing that backs it up, though. There's nothing that substantiates these reports. There's nothing that says that he liked to do any of those things that people like to spout that he did. So that's the bottom line. I'll leave it at that. We spent enough time on this.
So this was very tabloidy stuff, pretty much, of just like this one guy said it and everybody decided to run with it just because he got a few things right about Hitler.
Well, the thing is that the U.S. during that time tried to get a lot.
You're over the time period.
Well, they tried to get a lot of psychological reports on Hitler so they could understand the decisions that he was making, because it was a ruler during a time doing very extreme things that they were not used to seeing at such a grand level, you know, just exterminating a race because of what their beliefs or anything like that.
It got increasingly erratic towards the end, too.
Exactly. And
meth will do that.
It's just they were trying to anticipate his next move in order to prepare for it. And that you can understand. You want to be prepared. You want to be able to react when you know what something's coming, you know?
He threw everything at the wall. Like, I feel like if that didn't work, the next volume two would have been like, okay, so I'm not saying Hitler ate an entire baby, but he like had a little bit of baby, at least, you know, that type of deal. Like that, it's what you can do to build your national identity and just make the grand enemy.
And it's important to note,
which you didn't need to do for Hitler. He was already that. No,
he had enough fire in their flames.
And a little, I guess, whistle letter for you. Something to think about, too. You got to think about the 40s, is that anything involving what they would consider sexual deviancy is a hot button issue. So, like, it's something that if you think about, you can look at the cultural stuff with sexual oppression in America and all these different ideas, that it's not just that. It's like, by today's standards, anyone's, you know, sexual proclivities and what they prefer is kind of like, oh, you know, we're a little more open-minded. It's like, oh, it might be a little different or weird to me, but whatever, people do their own thing. But anything that was anything remotely not standard heterosexual heterosexual sex in its act
was
seen as like depraved and something to attack people for.
Greg, I'm gonna pull a historical lens on you right now.
Go for it.
But I really believe that when it comes to talking about stuff with the 40s,
and we can actually wrap this up because Josh did a noble effort to try to rein us in.
Yes, but I'll just say, like,
I'm reeling in that fishing reel, y'all still nibbling.
Everybody knew about that type of stuff because I will say it wasn't as publicized back then. I really feel like the number of people that were into their things is no less or more than it is today.
Sure.
Just, it's more just swept under the carpet because they needed a national identity. They needed the idea of a nuclear family and an idea of this identity to congeal over in that time. And therefore, it wasn't as publicized about. There were more things to worry about. We are technically in the most peaceful time that there ever has existed.
Yes.
So we have the time to talk about these extra things like sexuality, genderism, anything like that. But back then, it was one of those where it's not important enough to worry about it. And if you really get out of line, we'll shun you for it.
It's the importance of othering. It really gets down.
Yeah.
So yeah,
there were still whole communities based around that stuff. It just wasn't as there wasn't like Tumblr, MySpace, Twitter, anything like that to really express it on. You just had to know the right people. So I mean,
you had your select group.
So,
anyway, I'm done with that.
Hope we weren't too soapboxy.
Well, we're about to get into a hot topic, but, you know, another hot button issue.
I don't know how hot button this one is. Mine? No. See, my topic is just about the Pope owning a fish farm, and that's why Catholics only eat fish on Fridays during Lent.
I was really excited to see this topic, actually.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So I would like to say, aside from Josh over here, Josh was like, we're in a strange situation because in New Orleans...
I'm really curious where you're going with this.
Well, no, because in New Orleans, the population is predominantly Roman Catholic, at least by baptism. I'm not saying practicing or anything like that.
By trade.
Yes, by trade. It's like as almost an identity, I would say, just to the fact that, like, you know, we name, so we have parishes here. That's a Roman Catholic thing. We name a lot of streets.
St. Charles Parish.
Yeah, we name a lot of streets after Roman Catholic saints.
Yeah.
It's just something that runs in the blood of New Orleans, whether you are any, whether you are Muslim, Buddhist, Catholic, Jewish, atheist, anything, you know a bit about Catholicism living in New Orleans because of everything you're involved with. All the schools here, like the biggest schools in New Orleans, essentially, are mainly private schools, and they're all either, if not Catholic, they're Christian schools. It's a very weird system.
Yeah, and not only that, I mean, when you think of the New Orleans skyline or, like, if you want to think of New Orleans in a picture, it's the St. Louis Cathedral.
Yeah.
And it is, I just out of curiosity, I looked it up. So it is 35.9% of New Orleans is Catholic and is the dominant religion.
I honestly thought it would be higher.
Yeah, I really thought it would be higher too, but that's, but, I mean, it's still, it's over a third.
With that.
That means one of us is Catholic.
Is the second one Baptist? Just curious.
This is off a Wikipedia page, doesn't list Baptist.
So okay. But anyway, so with that in mind, I always assumed that Catholicism was a much more normal thing than it is in the rest of the United States, which is predominantly Protestant. I mean, Josh, you were raised Protestant. You were Episcopalian, right?
There we go. Yeah, we go. Yeah.
That's Protestant.
Yeah, but I'm just...
Catholic light.
Yes, Catholic light. So anyway...
We don't like our fucking statues and we don't like our Pope.
Actually, I think that was a quote that from is one the of actual, the elders.
Like, that is pretty much the only difference between Episcopalian and Catholicism. Like, that is it.
And interpretive dogma, too, from what I understand.
Yeah, yeah, tomato, potato.
So,
potato, tomato.
What we're going on is there is a Catholic tradition during Lent, which is the 40 days up to and including the crucifixion, death, and resurrection of Christ is when Catholics...
I was just telling us 12% second highest.
Yeah, so
based on one source, Baptists
are second highest. Okay.
Yeah, so anyway, Baptists and Catholics are about 50% of the city.
Lent is the period of, I guess, atonement, sacrifice,
Mardi Gras,
fasting,
Mardi Gras.
Mardi Gras comes right before that.
But after you get hammered, blackout drunk on Fat Tuesday, Mardi Gras,
you then start prepping for Easter.
Then you start f-ing atoning for your sins.
Yeah, little known as the New Orleans Easter Bender that we prep for 40 days. It's a 40-day tolerance break from alcohol or something.
That's pretty much it.
So we fill our little eggs. We just dip them in tequila and we just let them soak in. You eat it shell and all. So. Getting back to the actual thing, Lent is the preparatory time of, I guess, reflection and sacrifice. So you honor Jesus for his sacrifice for saving everybody for their sins. He died for your sins. And on Fridays during Lent, it is tradition that Catholics do not eat meat. However, so apparently fish don't count as meat.
Now, I also do want to also kind of interject here. I also, in my mind, believed that all Catholics fasted, but at some point I also realized that we live in New Orleans where seafood is abundant.
Yes.
Oh boy, yeah, we'll get to, I think the seafood thing is such a cop out.
Yeah, at some point I was kind of like, the wheel started turning and I'm like, we live in the fucking seafood capital of the United States, basically. So, you know, there's got to be some, like, patting on the back here and some money, you know, getting slid in somewhere, you know, kind of thing.
More pertinent than you think. So, the crux of this is that there's a few different rumors going around this one, and I'll cover all of them. But essentially, it is that there was a financial or at least some benefit to a pope for instating a fast that only included fish on Fridays.
Meaning that fish was exempt from counting as meat.
Yes.
Okay.
And some people said it was because, you know, back then people didn't consider fish to be, you know, only warm-blooded animals were considered meat. But I don't think that
really
endothermy and exothermy were really hotly understood until relatively recently.
I was going to say, I don't think that was a big player in that ball game.
Right. So I'm going to go ahead and just kind of preamble this with a little excerpt from a completely unsourced site that I went to, which I actually don't know what the point of this article was or what I guess the message getting across, whose side they're on. It's really weird. And it is quoted as...
Well, wait. Do you know who the author is?
It's thecowshow.com.
It's probably Uncle Rusty.
Greg, can you go to thecowshow.com and see some recent articles on it?
I'm absolutely going incognito mode for this.
This is from 2010.
No, no. We're asking for the cow show, not the donkey show. I just want you to look at
the picture from it real quick. Oh, my God.
Please do not look that up, people. I'm not responsible if you do.
So
what do you want me to look at? I'm on thecowshow.com.
I was in Mexico.
Just look at regular articles and just tell me other things that come from this website.
Colfax Marathon. Movies that give me nightmares. Arachnophobia. That's a list of movies. Mabi. It's a very poorly formatted website.
So my point is they haven't really...
How to: bacon.
How to bacon.
Damn it. So anyway, this guy, he gave an article of the quote unquote real reasons Catholics don't eat meat on Fridays. And he explains that, you know, Catholics don't eat, you know, meat on Fridays in Lent. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to go ahead with a few of different things that he pulled up. He did Google searches. So he's like us. Let's see. And he talks about how, number one, Jesus was a vegetarian, according to him. Secondly, he said that, now here's where it gets interesting. It seems that there may have been some economical implications to this theory as well. The tradition of eating fish on Fridays and not other meat was, strangely enough, for economical purposes. Back when the religion was smaller, most of its members were poor fishermen, so in order to help their trade, the church decreed that all Catholics should eat fish on every Friday. Eventually, this was changed to be done only during Lent, but it was originally done to help the fishermen's trade. Okay, that doesn't sound out of the norm.
Like, I was going to say, like, why, you know, if you're, not audience, what's the word I'm looking for, but like there's a certain term I'm looking
demographic?
For. Demographic? Yeah, like if your target demographic, exactly, if their, you know, moneymaker is basically fish, you're going to want to appeal to them.
He goes on with this quote. The real reason for this is not biblical, nor does it have anything to do with God. The Pope lives in Rome, Italy, for a very long time ago. The fishing industry needed to make more money, so religious leaders decided that they would make a one day a week, a meatless day, thus being okay to eat fish that day, which became a law. The fishermen were happy now. They had more money and could support the church. Okay, innocent enough still. Not that weird. And then this is where he gets a little bit odd. He says, according to a couple of atheist message boards on the topic, the Pope's brother-in-law was a whole...
I don't think he had proper venom for that.
According to a couple of atheist
there we go.
Message boards on the topic...
I feel it in my plums.
The Pope's brother-in-law was in the wholesale fish business. And then he has a little aside. Scratch his chin. Ah, now isn't that interesting? Goes on to quote.
Please tell me did not say scratch his chin.
Look at it.
Oh my God, it says scratch his chin.
I can see the fedora from here through the screen.
Jesus Christ.
But this guy is like a Christian holy roller type of like fedora tipper.
Yeah.
Hey, he's a strange breed.
My Jesus.
My savior.
Oh God.
Oh, that's good.
So many years ago.
I'm a savior.
Many years ago, the fishermen discovered how to catch more fish, and they were unable to sell the extra fish and wanted the weekend off. Yes, because weekends were implemented back before. It's like
Jesus Christ.
That was an American thing. The weekend didn't exist. And look, continuing.
I thought everybody was working for the weekend.
It just so happened that the fisherman's wife and the mistress. It just so happened that the fisherman's wife was the mistress of the ongoing pope. I didn't know anybody called an ongoing pope. So she held back her favors until the Pope had made it a rule for all those in his kingdom, eat fish on Friday.
Okay.
So it is written.
Wait. Let's stop right here. Okay. So she's the mistress to the Pope, which in theory is the most powerful person within that community.
Oh, I won't f*** you to my brush, making more money.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. And my problem with that is if that she's clearly banging numero uno within that community, why is she concerned about her husband making money?
I mean, she is a working girl that likes to make sure that her whole family is supported. And if you have to use unconventional means, Josh, and not be so judgmental.
I'm just saying.
The question is about faith and belief, not fact or imperial thinking you need to close examination. Sort of like religion. It's all about make-believe.
What?
Okay, the edge that's an dripping
actual,
from that.
That's an actual, the it's all about make-believe. From that
makes me want to flip this table.
And then here we go, continues. This is a Christian edgelord. Good old atheists always chiming in with their two cents. And then he keeps on going. There are two odd exceptions to this. At one point, church authorities declared beaver meat could be considered fish, and there was a similar situation in the South American semi-aquatic mammal known as the capybara, which was also declared a quote-unquote fish for the purpose of Lent because it lived mostly in the water. Note that neither beavers nor capybara are domestic animals. Eating them wouldn't cut into the core livestock needed to maintain the farms in the spring.
Do you know why they ate beavers? It tasted like raspberries.
So here's the weird part. I'll get back to this, but that part's true. The whole beaver and capybara thing?
Yeah, I know. That's true. Okay, I was making a call.
Nice callback.
Thank you.
Anyway, and the last one he said, most importantly, the Pope owned a giant fish factory back in the day and made everyone buy his steam flounder, plucked right out of the ocean, of course, so that he could make money off of it. There you have it, folks. Now get to McDonald's and quick and pick up the couple of fillet of fish before it's too late.
It's fillet, right?
It's fillet. I think it's fillet.
It's fillet of fish.
I don't know. But anyway, this guy has a really weird tone that bounces back between him being like, yeah, eat up your corporate fish, you little plebs. To
fucking shills.
To like, atheists are stupid, you know, that type of deal. This guy, I'm not trying to get religious with this, for the record. This guy just is a terrible writer. So now here are the facts. This guy kind of covered, I read that article almost in full because it covers most of the ideas behind it. You know, the Pope had a mistress that had a brother that liked to, you know, sell fish because it was his hobby, and she decided to, you know, only give him the goody-goody when he decided to make it a law that you can only eat fish on Fridays, all the way to the Pope himself had a fish factory. Supposedly, this was Paul IV. Now, what documents do they have to back this up? None. Absolutely none.
Oh, that's good.
Apparently, the whole fasting became a thing, number one, every Friday of the year in the 1200s. It was
complete abstinence
on Fridays from meat. All year. And then it was not only until 1966.
Well, I will say that I would not make it in that time frame because I do not practice abstinence.
Right. But until 1966, when Paul VI came in, he said that it was okay to only do it on the Fridays during Lent.
Okay.
So that's actually really interesting that only in the 1960s was it that it was only Lent. Before that, it was every Friday. Really weird to me.
Yeah, that doesn't quite make a whole lot of sense why it took so long to get to that point.
Yes. So we'll go to the implications of the fish trade and how the religion actually does tie into it.
Okay.
Cod at the time of the Viking voyages was one of the most consumed, most easily obtained, and also one of the most easily preserved types of food at the during that time. So they were trying to find good fishing spots for that to pretty much provide for everyone else. And a lot of people believe that sometimes, like, the New World was actually partly discovered because of an effort to find more cod fishing spots.
Who would have known people from Minnesota would actually be so productive?
So it turns out the fish actually does, yes. The Minnesota Vikings.
Yeah, thank you.
So anyway, they actually do play a big part economically in world development. But one
Well, besides the whole conquering Rome.
Yes, that too. But it wasn't the Vikings.
They were Vikings.
The Visigoths?
Part of the Visigoths were Vikings.
Oh.
Yes.
You're going to get torn down. I'll get Daniele Bolle back here right now.
There was definitely some Vikings. Maybe they were German Vikings. Maybe they weren't the same Vikings.
They're not Vikings then. They have to be from Scandinavia.
That doesn't.
I'm just going to go ahead and leave that on the table for somebody else to suss
out. That's fine. Send us an email. Roomflies@gmail.com.
So anyway, the actual religious implication for fish and pretty much abstaining from it comes from, of all places, Britain.
Really?
And it's thanks to one of the least religious people, Henry VIII. And do we know about him?
He's the one who ate all the time, right?
He had trouble with love.
Yeah.
So
I believe yesterday I was talking to someone and we decided that he was like the original men's rights activist.
Yeah, he was essentially.
Are you saying he's the first red pillar?
I actually then said, I think he might have been a founding member of Red Pill.
Okay, yeah.
So Henry VIII, if anybody does not know some of the bullet points about him.
Is he the one with the turkey in the picture?
That is the one that people thought had the turkey in the picture. Okay,
that's why I asked. He ate a lot.
So Henry VIII actually he wanted to have a lot of wives. He was not very decisive. He really just needed a male heir and none of them were given to him. He was very infatuated with a particular Anne Boleyn at one point, though, and tried to get an annulment from his previous marriage so he could marry Anne Boleyn.
Real nice.
The Catholic Church said no, so he went on to start his own religion.
Oh.
Now, as I had said before...
Oh, what religion was that?
The Anglican Church.
Thank you.
Yes. So, he went pretty far just to get some, you know...
Screw you guys. I'm making my own fucking church with blackjack and hookers. It's basically what he did.
Yes. Anyway, so continue with Henry VIII. At this time, it was still a no meat on Fridays, except for fish type of deal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when Henry VIII separated, made this other sort of church, England was split. A lot of them still liked to remain Catholic, but then there was the whole Protestant thing, and some people went to the Anglican church to the point where it became political to
really?
Eat fish on Fridays. Like, eating fish became a political statement that was mixed up with religion at the time.
Where was TMZ when you needed them?
Right. It was really weird how that worked. So much to the point that the fish trade was suffering so much that his successor, Edward VI, actually had to re-implement the fasting on Fridays in the Anglican Church.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
It was hurting the actual national economy. So that is where that little grain of truth came from. It wasn't the technical pope, but it was Henry VIII that did that type of thing. Well, actually Edward VI. Now, the whole thing with the pope, that really, the whole fish farm, I came up dry on any sort of valid sources that said that the pope had a fish farm of any sort. NPR did a whole lovely article on this that I mainly sourced this from.
Well, I mean, I'm just going to like kind of jump in here, and I could be completely wrong here, which wouldn't be that abnormal. Who was the first pope of the church?
The first pope of the church was considered to be Paul, I want to say.
Peter.
Peter.
It was Peter. Peter.
What was his trade?
Fisherman.
I think that's kind of where it comes from.
Checkmate, atheist.
I mean, that's just my logic here.
No, I think it was older than that. I mean, yes, there were probably a lot of people in the working classes. I mean, Jesus was a blue-collar prophet.
I mean, I get that. But like, from my just very basic, like, thinking out loud kind of thing, you can kind of see, like, the first pope of this religion now that's so big, especially, you know, where we are, the first pope was a fish farmer.
Well, fish are very much tied into the Catholic religion and Christianity in general. Some of the symbols for Jesus are the fish.
Turning the
loaves of bread into fish, too. Wasn't
he
that
just
one of them?
Multiplied. He just multiplied them.
But, multiplied the fish, multiplied
but
the bread.
But still, yeah. Like...
Did not turn bread into fish.
Yeah, yeah. And then also,
you don't
I
know
mean,
that. You weren't there.
I mean, it is a very common recurring term.
So. I will concede the point.
It was a very common recurring term in Christianity, and also, you know, that's tied to, like, the sacrifice. So, like, you know, it's almost like you're eating the body of Christ, but eating the fish type of deal. I think it's more of an archaic thing from the religion that kind of got muddled over time.
Right.
That is just me speculating right there. Mm-hmm. But it had nothing to do with the Pope having a
fish farm.
Mistress
or
that had a fish farm or anything like that. There were popes that had mistresses. There was something called the Avignon Papacy, which was a very corrupt time period in the Catholic Church, to the point where they moved essentially the Vatican to a certain part of France where they could just have their bang fest. You know, the Pope wasn't exactly a religious figure at one point. It was more of a political figure.
Oh, yeah, because they dictated the law.
Yeah. I mean...
The ability to excommunicate was like...
Yeah.
Essentially, papal...
Snap the fingers.
Papal law was government law in some time period.
Oh, yeah.
But a little bit of ingenuity came from this whole thing in 1966, like I said, when Paul VI actually made it more lenient to not fast on Fridays from meat. So, like I said, everybody ate fish on Fridays every Friday of the year up until 1966. Now, when it was just reduced to that 40 days, fish prices plummeted to the point where nobody was really...
It wasn't sustainable.
Yeah, it wasn't sustainable.
And
there was a big hit to the economy at the time.
And I think, I'm not 100% sure on this, but I want to say it was JP2, as my teacher liked to call him, but John Paul II even made it a point to come out and say that only eating fish on Fridays is not official Catholicism doctrine.
It is more of a guideline or a tradition.
Right.
However, once again, I said the capybara and the beaver thing was true because Venezuela actually did pass that. Like one of the popes said,
oh, it was a law.
We'll leave it up to you bishops to decide things. And they said, okay, it's actually okay for capybara and beavers to be eaten because they were a nuisance at one point.
That's like them saying Nutria around here.
Yeah. Nutria never took off as a dish.
But my point being is that something that's very prevalent and destructive.
Yeah, it was kind of like knocking out two birds with one stone. And in New Orleans, in 2013, Archbishop Gregory Amon, who I actually know, and he's a very nice guy. I have nothing bad to say about him.
Oh, name dropping.
Well, no. He's really cool.
F***ing Mr. Big Chat.
He actually decided that alligator is considered fish on Fridays. So
I remember that now.
Huh. Yep, he declared alligator.
I actually did not know that.
I mean, they're cold-blooded, so he considers alligator to be on the plate, pretty much, for New Orleans.
Well,
at least.
Greg doesn't have taste buds, but Ron, you can back me up on this. Alligator's delicious.
Alligator is
fantastic.
Alligator is like chicken with fish's texture. It's flaky like fish, but it tastes like chicken.
Dat dog does a really good.
Wow. Alligator sausage doesn't.
Dat dog does everything amazing.
Yes.
Gator sausage totally. Can.
Okay. This episode brought to you by Dat dog.
Okay. Dat dog.
Please.
Oh God. I will be paid in hot dogs. Dat dog is a local New Orleans hot dog establishment restaurant that makes.
Are we
going to
provide
spin.
The addresses too?
Really, I mean, quick though, they don't.
But they
charge
need to,
for the toppings.
But
it's
they
amazing.
Need to understand the reference.
Yeah.
Like, they make their own special kind of hot dogs, and, like, it is all across the board. Like, duck, alligator, you know, things all across the board. Anyway.
Guinness dog. Very good.
Oh, so good.
Wasabi on the Guinness dog. Oh, even better.
It's amazing.
Stop.
So if you're ever in New Orleans.
Hey, what are you guys doing after this?
Right?
I would buy that dog.
To continue with this thread and end it, I will leave it on the fact that after this whole 1966 fallout with... pretty much just droppage in, you know, these damn Catholics not eating meat on Fridays. There was this one industrious McDonald's franchise owner named Lou Grian, who said,
crematory?
Oh man, nobody's buying my burgers on Fridays.
Crematory.
I really need to, yes, crematory.
Crematory.
I really need to come up with something to get my sales up for my McDonald's franchise. And he invented
the McRib.
No.
No.
I miss the McRib. He invented something called the filet of fucking fish.
Fillet of fish.
So, Catholics, you're to thank for the filet of fish. You can sing that whole Moana song to everyone for that one.
What can I say besides you're welcome?
Let's continue, Josh.
Okay.
Josh, you got something a little bit less religious and more ridiculous, I guess.
Yes.
More American. We're getting to the American section of this now.
Can I call in like the... Dun, 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 dun? That'd be great. Anyway, my last topic of the night is going to be about President Taft.
And the rumor
Pop
flies
quiz,
coin
Pop quiz, what's the name of that song?
What?
Pop quiz, what's the name of the song you just tried to reference?
Fucking O Ye Faithful? I don't
know. Anyone? Hail to the Chief.
Ah, you're right. That's right.
This is a rumor flies coin term that I think we have not seen anywhere else, have we?
No, in all of my research, I don't believe I saw this anywhere. And so the rumor is that President William Taft died in a bathtub or got stuck in a bathtub.
And we're going to call it the...
Taft Tub.
Yeah.
And I'm going to claim it because I just Google searched and the top 10 hits, none of them say Taft Tub.
All right.
None of them. It is ours. We are planting that rumor flies flag.
Copyright rumor flies 2017.
It's somewhere between a bathtub and a traditional jacuzzi.
That's pretty good.
I'm fine with all of this. Anyway, so for those of you who don't know, President William Taft was the 27th president of the United States. I had no idea what number he was before I researched this. I knew he was a president at some point in time.
I expected more of you, Josh.
I had no idea. I'll give you Washington, I'll give you Adams, and then it's a crapshoot. Okay, Lincoln 16, we'll see what happens after. Most people believe this to be true, that Taft died or got stuck in the bathtub because he
Taft
was
tub.
And because of the Taft tub, because President Taft was a cheeky fellow.
I hadn't heard of that he died, and I just heard that he got stuck in it.
I've heard both.
Oh wow.
Yeah, if you search like into Google, there will be results that President William Taft died in a bathtub. Anyway, he was kind of portly. He was a chubby chubster. He was a tubby bunny.
I'm looking at a picture of President Taft right now.
He was a fatty, okay?
He looks like Take Tweedledum and make him a president in a three-piece tuxedo. That's President Taft.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Well, okay, he got up to around 350 pounds. He was the largest president we've ever had in the United States.
He could throw a keg right over the White House lawn.
He absolutely could. He was about 6 feet tall, so he wasn't like a very like astronomically tall human being, but his peak weight was around 350 pounds is what they say. So that's where people get this notion from, though, because he was a bigger dude, and his peak weight was that much, and that was not the weight, though, at the end of his presidency, nor the end of his life. He ended up seeing that he needed to make a change in his life, so he was proactive about it, and every day from his house, he decided to walk to the Capitol, which was about 3 miles, and...
No shit. Really?
I swear to God. He walked.
That's actually really impressive given like he was pretty heavy.
So and
that's
there's a long actually walk. A specific crosswalk that he crossed at in DC that they renamed like Taft Avenue or Taft Walkway or whatever.
Does it have a natural dip in it?
Oh my God. So within the last couple months of his life, he ended up getting down to being about 250 pounds. He lost about 100 pounds.
I was going to say, that's actually like.
That's no, football that's player size. That's impressive. It's great. It's wonderful. That's impressive. His health started to decline, and I mean, ultimately, it really didn't make that much of a difference. To
net
be honest
zero.
With you. But he at least made a proactive effort, and he lost a good chunk of weight. Now, people probably made some connections about him dying in the tub or getting stuck in the tub because of his big old belly.
My question, real quick, is: was this his turning point?
What do you mean?
Like. This whole myth, was this his turning point to getting healthier or no?
No, it was not. Because he was the chief of justice after he was president. He was the first person to ever be president of the United States, then be the chief of justice.
Man, they really wanted him on still.
And he was the first president ever to be buried in Arlington National Cemetery, if I'm correct.
Oh, interesting.
Huh. Yes. So...
The good Virginia, right?
Yes. West Virginia. So... A lot of this, I believe, comes from the fact that there had to be a special bathtub installed, which became the Taft tub, because he wouldn't fit in the normal White House bathtub. And there's a very famous picture, which I have in the show notes, which I've seen before. Ryan and Greg have not, but it's of four men who are sitting in a bathtub, which was the Taft tub.
Yeah, you just showed us this before we recorded.
And they're not small human beings.
No. It's literally four full-grown men. I wasn't joking where I said somewhere between bathtub and full-grown and like traditional jacuzzi.
Yeah, no, you're totally right.
Can totally confirm that President Taft was, in fact, the first president buried in Arlington.
It's
good
like,
job.
It's like a deep
no penalty shot for you.
Oh, I got more coming, don't worry. So people probably made those connections, and that's probably where a lot of this originated. And there was... a very heated election in 1912 after Teddy Roosevelt served his two terms where Taft ran. And a lot of Roosevelt supporters were not a fan of him and they were very vocal about his weight. So I think that also very much played a part into it.
Roosevelt was pretty heavy set himself.
Yeah, that's the thing though, is that Roosevelt was not a small man.
He needed to ride like a Clydesdale.
But you know, Roosevelt was the American man. He was, you know, Mr. America. He was a fucking rough rider. Like, he rode his horses, like, he drank his whiskey, had his mustache and everything.
Yeah, he was that.
Like, he was the epitome of what every American man should have been then. At least in their minds, you know?
Didn't like non-white people, though.
Well, you know, you win some, you lose some. And the thing, though, is that a lot of his supporters did not like Taft. And oddly enough, a lot of people credit Taft with being the sole reason the Republican Party survived is because he won that election in 1909.
Really?
Yes. Which blows my mind. So going back to the tub, though, that picture of the four men inside the Taft tub was taken actually before, I believe it was 1907, before it actually went to the White House.
Wait, so you think that like Taft saw this in a Sears catalog and was just like...
I think it was 1907. I'm not 1,000% sure, but it was that picture was taken definitely before it was ever installed inside the White House. So when you look at that famous picture inside the show notes, they're not inside the White House when they're taking it.
That'll do. I want that in the White House.
That's. I mean, his name was Big was Wild. What was it? I'm sorry, Big Bill for Christ's sake. That was his nickname. That's they called William Taft, President Taft. Big
appropriate.
Bill.
I mean, yeah.
Well, you know,
Big Bill wants the bathtub.
Big Brown the bathtub.
I'll make the bathtub my bathtub.
It's so stupid.
I don't have enough of a handlebar mustache to talk through. To
I get don't that know. Right I want to twirl it though when you say it.
He had a mean mustache.
It was wonderful. And the last thing I will end on. So okay, that was not true. He did not get stuck in the bathtub. There was a bunch of claims throughout his life that he got stuck in a bathtub by many different people, whether it was like him campaigning or him going different places, like staying in hotels, that he got stuck. But then there was nothing that substantiated those claims. Not one. There was one that came out in 1963 that a lot of people point to as well. I forget her name.
63, that's a bit late.
Yeah, I know. Oh, that's the other thing, is that this was made up about two decades after he served.
Really?
Yeah. So this was not something that really caught any waves until many, many years later.
So it's similar to like Abe Lincoln shooting an apple off of his wife's head.
Yes.
Okay.
Nailed it.
That mustache is actually incredibly glorious.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't joking. He's like the American Churchill.
So I will say, though, one thing that may or may not, this is pure speculation on Pappy Josh right here. One thing that may play into the fact that he got stuck in the tub or he died in the tub was because President Taft and his Justice Department were involved in a breaking up a bathtub trust. That was a cartel of porcelain makers who were bent on creating a price-fixing monopoly that controlled bathtubs and toilets. So maybe that plays some factor. That's really all I got. That's the only thing that was literally the only connection between Taft and bathtubs that I made.
Look here, we're against the deep state. We're going to break up big shitter. They're not going to have monopoly, all right?
That's pretty much what he did.
It's only shitter if you're waffle stomping.
Oh my God, it might have been two forms of toilet back then. Manual flush and then just flush.
Manual flush and foot flush.
Well, were they as technologically advanced back then to have the graded shower?
Ryan, I wasn't alive then. Drains? I don't know. I can't go without my cell phone. You think I know these things?
Greg, you live in an old house. Do they have graded shower drains?
Most modern places don't have original plumbing and showers in them. That's not, like, you'd actually be pretty hard pressed to find that.
Poser.
It's all about the windows.
So, Josh, before we go on to the special guest of the night, I want to ask, do you think the Taft Tub still exists?
I mean, in what capacity? Like, are there bathtubs that they make that are still that large? Obviously, at least
a four-person capacity, if you're going for literal. But I'm thinking of, like, does that actual bathtub still exist? Because, I mean, it is technically a historical artifact. I mean, he didn't drown in it. He didn't die in it. He didn't get stuck in it. But that thing probably still exists. And I don't think they have a current present. Like, can you see Jimmy Carter just, like, wading around in the bathtub, like, doing laps in it at that point? That is a big fucking tub.
That was a really big tub.
I mean, it's very large.
Somebody has to have it somewhere.
If I had to guess, I'm sure it's a historical artifact.
It's in a dolphin conservatory somewhere. It's
somewhere. Like, there's definitely, like, platypuses swimming in it or something.
Maybe. But I don't know. Anyway, so you don't know that one.
No, I don't. And I don't care enough to make Rick listen.
So
up
it's
either.
BS. It's BS. Yes. Taft did not get stuck.
No, Taft did not get stuck. He did not die. That man was a trooper. I'll tell you this much. Like, towards the end of his life,
they play the Rocky theme with him trying to lose weight while walking to Congress.
He definitely, like, he was sick and he still made the most of, like, trying to serve his country. There was, like, some very important votes that he needed to be a part of, and he couldn't make it there because he was so ill, but he still sent in, like, his resolution and, like wrote very, very detailed papers and articles explaining his feelings and things like that to pass along the vote to Congress. Like,
yeah, I mean, we've made mirth of this, but at the same rate, like, I respect him as a president, obviously.
And I will say that he was one of the better presidents that could dance.
He danced?
Oh, yeah.
Probably very graceful, I
imagine. No, I swear to God, they said that dude could cut a rug.
I've never heard that term.
Never heard cut a rug?
Never heard that term?
No.
Oh, yeah, dude.
Sorry, I guess I've been living under a rock.
He is totally not the bee's knees.
No, he is not the bee's knees. That's for damn sure.
Jesus Christ.
And
I'm going to go ahead and just listen to my electro swing after this. You heard about Caravan Palace, right?
Nah.
I'll show you them later.
But I would say, I actually did not know anything about the weight loss stuff. And when I was looking at those pictures, I saw some shots of him that were pretty thin. I was like, wow, yeah, I had no idea he had, like, a substantial weight loss.
Yeah, he, like, went a huge lifestyle change, man, and, like, really made the most of it. Because he felt like he was getting to be that his weight was being a hindrance on him serving his country. That's basically that's what really it boils down to.
That is self-sacrifice. Well, it's also helping him too in the long run.
Yeah, but he
went from like incandescent noble to motivation. Halogen.
He was a public servant to the fullest extent. He really was.
Only could be so gloriously incandescent.
So anyway, so now this is the point of the show where we pass on the baton to the special guest of the night, who is Greg. Take the baton.
Woo!
Take the baton.
That's a beer bottle.
I grabbed it.
That's a beer bottle.
Yeah, I just finished it. So, you know, throw that away for me when you get a chance. What are you covering tonight, Greg?
Lyndon B. Johnson! So yes, Lyndon B. Johnson. We had a lot of wonderful little... oh God, I forgot what the B stands for. Anyway, so LBJ. there are a lot of myths about LBJ. There are so many to cover and a lot of things. So I'm going to touch on a few quick ones, but the big thing we're going to talk about is obsession with his...
Johnson.
Thank you.
Particularly that he had no problem revealing it to anyone that was not asking.
It goes... so much further. So we're going to start with my number of sources for this are many. So I'm not going to rattle off every single source here, but I'm going to grab a few of the highlights that I think are worth mentioning. So first thing we're talking about is the Johnson treatment, quote unquote. Apparently his staff would call it this. And you can
wait,
look
which
at,
staff?
Yeah, I was going to say, where are we going with this? God. The Johnson treatment and his staff would call
we
it
have
this?
So this is... the most dick jokes we've done in one episode, and it's...
He is a very intimidating, tall, loud Texas man. He is...
Oh, that's right. He was from Texas, yes, wasn't he?
He is very loud.
I feel like he would have run a car dealership with like a giant inflatable chicken on top of it or something had he lived a different life.
Yes.
He sounds like the opposite of Ted Cruz.
So this guy would... he was generally pretty funny. He's very boisterous, but he would just get really intense, very fiery. And so he would scream at you. He'd intimidate you. There's so many photos of him literally leaning into people, finger between them and him, just screaming at them about something.
Dude, I hate face talkers in the first place.
Oh,
there was
is.
This one person I knew that just every time she talked to me, I was like, are you going in for a kiss or not? This is very awkward. My fiance is right next to me. Stop.
You need to respect the personal bubble.
Yeah. And he had zero respect for it.
Mm-hmm.
A great example was he was talking to one of his drivers who, now LBJ, as you know, was a very big civil rights activist. Actually, he was very instrumental in Civil Rights Act and very instrumental stuff. You can talk all day about whether or not he practiced what he preached, but he oversaw a lot of change in the racial structure in America as far as legality goes.
Good president and good person are not mutual.
Yeah. So he, for instance, when his driver, who was black, turned to him and said, pretend you're a goddamn piece of furniture. Now, whether that's racial or not is kind of irrelevant. The point just being, this guy really didn't care who he was talking to and would just scream and yell at people for any reason. I'm sure his driver probably said nothing to him and didn't deserve it. But just, it's a quote from a book anyway. So that's just like a very par for the course statement from him. So
that's the sampling.
It is, though. It's like, that's a example. Another example is there's a picture. It was on Reddit today, actually, of JFK and LBJ. So as you know, LBJ was JFK's vice president when JFK was assassinated. He became the
president.
He
was sworn in. Yeah.
So Johnson is very famously, it's that it has JFK is about to give a speech. And at the podium, apparently the airplane engines are way too loud. So you see Johnson turning, the camera's got a direct line of sight on his face, and he is screaming, like, finger out at this guy to turn off the engines, and JFK's leaning over, grabbing by the shoulder, trying to calm him down. It is spectacular.
It's fine.
His personality in a nutshell. Yeah. You can just literally just be like, hey, asshole! Turn that off! Like you can just see it, right? Like
Lyndon, I don't even have a mic yet. Just it's
okay. Yeah, Lyndon, like, it's cool. It's cool.
Lyndon, stop.
We talked about this.
We're leaving. We're not even going to talk here. We're not even talking here. We're getting on the plane.
Get in the car. We're leaving.
We're getting on the plane.
Another great example I'd always heard. My mother, a proud Texan, always loved talking about this story.
I didn't know your mother was a Texan.
Oh yeah, deep Southwest Texas, dude. She's like borderline Rio Grande territory. And she talked about how LBJ would drink and drive for fun at his ranch. And he would pull over, hold his cup out the window, and the Secret Service would have to refill it.
Also, he would have little fun signs where it would say he has to go 26.2 miles an hour, and he would go over the speed limit because he could. Private property, you can't tell him what not to do.
Because the police.
So as far as the specifics go of that, I did find multiple sources, and I've got time in here saying that he would absolutely drink and drive on his ranch with the Secret Service in tow. He would totally do that. Well, not the whole pulling over, doesn't matter. He would do – that was his idea of fun.
I'm not even going to touch that
which,
one.
Which, by the way, I guess Greg's rubbing off on me. Don't drink and drive. Let's throw that out there.
Don't drink and drive. But if you have a ranch where nobody else is driving.
Anyway, and then, so that's kind of just giving an idea of the larger.
The human being we're dealing
with. Yeah, the myth, like this guy is just story after story. A quick quote worth reading here from Time. The president drank Cutty Sark scotch and soda out of a large white plastic foam cup.
My kind of man.
Dude, did he double cup it? You got to double cup it for insulation.
Actually, my man.
Actually, I did screw this up because I thought it wasn't the case. I found this at the last second. I think my mom's story is actually pretty damn accurate. So anyway, the president drank Cutty Sark scotch and soda out of a large white plastic foam cup. Periodically, Johnson would slow down and hold his left arm outside the car, shaking the cup in ice. A Secret Service agent would run up to the car, take the cup, and go back to the station wagon. There, another agent would refill it with ice, scotch, and soda as the first agent trotted behind the wagon. Then, the first agent would run the refilled cup up to LBJ's outstretched and waiting hand as the president's car moved slowly along.
It was like a goddamn baton it was a hot race.
Swap. It was a hot swap.
Rutherford. Rutherford. No, my scotch is gone, Rutherford.
Like, him, like, holding it up. Marr! Marr! Like,
yeah, my kid, he would definitely be like that.
So let's get on to the Johnson part of Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
This dude was absolutely obsessed with his dick. It is hard to explain. I mean, I'm sure there's some stories that are blown out. Shut up. There are some stories that are absolutely blown out, I'm sure. And there's all these different like exaggerations. But the fact is the number of stories and just his actions alone speak volumes. So let me tell you a little bit about it. He would regularly in the bathroom.
Inches.
We need a number.
So his.
Tell me when to stop, Craig. Tell me when to stop.
So the staff at the White House would apparently regularly he'd be in the bathroom with you know, he'd be shaking out what he called Jumbo. And according to New Republic, he would sometimes swing around still holding his member, which he liked to call Jumbo, hooting once, "Have you ever seen anything as big as this?" and shaking it in an almost brandishing manner as he began discoursing about some pending legislation.
See, I know he didn't say it like that since he's from Texas, but I want to imagine it in the way Greg says, just waving it some way. "Have you ever seen anything as big as this?" he sounds like Shin Chan.
Prohibition needs to be repealed.
Mr. Elephant.
According to Politico, when journalists asked him why America was in Vietnam, quote, "That's why," Johnson reportedly said, as he whipped it out. In addition, in a recent book called The Residence, Inside the Private World of the White House by Kate Anderson Brower, he allegedly requested a total redo of the shower, which included a special nozzle pointed at his, quote, nether regions.
Jumbo needs a
so
shower.
So he can
there,
just
baby.
Get a bidet for his nuts? That would hurt.
When he faced resistance from the staff saying how difficult it would be to install, he said, quote, "If I can move 10,000 troops in a day, you can certainly fix the bathroom any way I want it."
He's not wrong.
I mean, the man's got a point.
It's just an extra pipe. Like, just... you could make it happen. And he's doing a favor for every president after that wants to get super soaked in the balls.
Yes. This is a guy who had numerous affairs and would have the Secret Service try to keep it from his wife.
Mm-hmm. See, the whole
but she knew, obviously, and it just didn't matter.
The whole affairs thing seems like he was really like trying to ride that JFK coattails type of thing.
Yeah, it was very much he was just... his masculinity was so fragile.
Actually, not even that. He probably had all the affairs in hopes that it would come out so he can be like, "Why do I have all these affairs? This is why."
Wow.
Exactly.
Dude, he this guy was...
it rolls sorry. Out like Mark Wahlberg in Boogie Nights.
Mr. President Johnson is... the irony, of course, of his last name aside, this guy was, I mean, there's so many sources. Y'all should read some of these things I've got in the show notes. He just was obsessed with it. He's obsessed with his wiener. He would not stop talking about it. He would literally brandish it in debates. He would brandish it to reporters. He was having numerous affairs.
Anybody who wanted to get a look, he showed it.
Anyway, that's basically it. It's that a lot of these myths about him are absolutely true. He was incredibly explosive personality. Is every story about him waving it around true? Probably not, but I would say it's probably safe to say that most of them
are. There is a suspension of disbelief the more he did it. But
it really is. There's so many sources for this stuff.
There's another one that I had heard of where one of his other intimidation tactics, was a very good negotiator in the fact that like he did it by intimidation. And one of his intimidation tactics that was more unconventional than most was anytime people would come in, I don't know exactly which type of people, if it was staff or just like congressional people that he didn't like.
Would he arrive by a dragon?
No, he wouldn't arrive by a dragon. But he would be on the toilet with the door open
and
in, and he would have the whole conversation with them while he was mid-defecation.
Yes, I've heard this before,
Greg,
as well.
Greg, did you see anything about that in the course of your research?
I think I saw some little bits about it, but I didn't really explore that too much.
This guy seems like... it's weird to say unhinged or anything like that because he still did a lot as a president, but... He's one of those.
I mean, he literally took over in one of the most
mental
traumatic...
floss claims it's true.
Look, Lyndon B. Johnson, for all his infatuations with his own member, took over in one of the most delicate times in modern United States history.
It was a tough.
And time. He ran with it, and you know, you may or may not agree with his stance on things and his policies, and like you said, practicing what he preached. But the man was able to take. And I guess this is just like me, like finding the good in everyone. Like he managed to take something that was one of the biggest atrocities in recent memory, you know, of the last, you know, 60, 70 years, whatever it is, inside the U.S., you know, and was able to transform the nation into something that was broken. It was very much broken and fragile and hollow. And he managed to make it whole and productive and, you know, kind of mended everything back together.
Yeah, so. I mean, that's a hard mantle to take up, especially when the previous president that you were following up on not only was very well loved, but was suddenly taken from the entire nation.
Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah. So I'm trying to give some credit. I mean, dude probably flashes dick at everyone, whatever.
But like I said, good person doesn't mean good president. Bad person doesn't mean bad president.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
There's that quote that we've said before, oftentimes great men are not good men. So,
have we said that before?
Yes, we talked about it for one of the history episodes.
Oh, okay.
I believe I said that to try to impress Daniele.
I don't think it works. I'm kidding. Well, this was a really fun episode. I love the fact that we could take these grab bag topics and kind of go all over the place and each take something that we normally wouldn't find inside of our comfort zone.
I think this is our first people-centric history episode. I think our Revolutionary War one was a little bit, but not completely.
We did the Revolutionary War?
Yeah, we did George Washington and Paul Revere.
Oh, okay.
It's all around that time period.
Okay, yeah, okay.
I know it was way back when we were such tiny podcasters and everything, Josh. No. But you got to think about your roots.
Rumor Fry Strong.
Yes.
But we also did...
big, strong episodes.
Oh, Christ. Sorry. We also did like Columbus and stuff during then too. So I didn't know if we were just going to kind of lump all that.
Such a piece
one.
Of shit.
Yeah, we know. I still hear it to this day. But I love the fact that we could just kind of explore all these different leaders. And if this is something you guys like, you know, please let us know. We really, really enjoy doing this history episode as opposed to focusing on a specific time.
I know we're 10.
Specific people.
This train's rails had a few figure eights in them where we just kind of went back and forth. But at the same rate, you know, I'm unapologetic for it at the moment. It was fun.
Well, look, I'll end this episode with the way we're going to end every episode now. We want to say thank you to all of our listeners.
Yes.
If you want to find out more of our stuff, anything that we've we've done, you can check out our website, rumorfliespodcast.com.
Yes.
Okay. And
literally and everything else.
And literally everything else with Rumor Flies. And be sure to check out patreon.com/rumorflies.
Yes, very much
Dark
so.
Dark Myths.
And we're also at the Dark Myths Collective. We plugged Monsters Among Us. There's a bunch of different great podcasts out there. Be sure to check them out. So for this episode of Rumor Flies, I'm Josh.
I'm Ryan.
And I'm Greg.
We'll see you guys next time.
Bye. Meh.